We continue. It is the Zach Gelb Show, coast to coast on CBS Sports Radio. Showtime Sports presents Goliath, the complete story of Wilt Chamberlain. Goliath will debut on demand and streaming on Friday, July 14th for all Paramount Plus with Showtime subscribers before making its on-air debut on Showtime on Sunday, July 16th at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, with episodes premiering each Sunday. Now joining us is the director of the docuseries, which I'm almost done with. I'm 2.5 episodes complete, got half of an episode left, and that, of course, is Chris Dillon. Chris, first off, congratulations. Appreciate the time. How are you?
I'm great, Zach. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what I thought was so unique here was to get Wilt's voice in the docuseries. You use artificial intelligence. Just take us through that process, because right before you tune into each and every episode of the docuseries, it's Wilt's family had to consent, and these were all previous quotes that Wilt has said before.
That's correct, and you hit on the key points for us. The big part for us of making this story, and I had a co-director in this, Rob Ford, who was huge in us helping to think through, how do we get more of Wilt's perspective in this? Because Wilt desperately wanted to have his story told. It was one of the things that made him the most sad in his life, was he felt misrepresented. And as we did the research into him, 100% agreed with that, both personally and also even in terms of his basketball, feeling like there's a disconnect here. And so how do we get Wilt's perspective in? And he wrote books. He wrote 3 autobiographies. So we're like, we can use Wilt's quotes and we can hire an actor, which is what we did, the normal sort of doc thing. And the actor read it and gave it the emotion. And then I suggested we could explore AI, because Wilt has so much audio out there that they can now take that and alter the actor's voice to sound like Wilt. But we wanted to make sure the family was okay with it. And we were only okay with it ethically because it was Wilt. It was his words, stuff he wrote and things that he was quoted as saying. We didn't write these words for him. And when we tried it out and sounded great and we showed it to the family and they were moved by it, because it was like hearing their uncle or their brother again, because these are the words that he would have said, because he did say them,
And also, this was just, it was so genuine by the family. And I thought just the little things where it was just the family talking about the height and how he didn't like the nickname Wilt the Stilt, and they called him Dip or Dippy for the Big Dipper. I thought that was pretty neat.
I mean, obviously, we're making this film. We call it a film, even though it's a series, but we looked at it as a story in 3 parts. Because Wilt is this revolutionary, important basketball player, arguably the most important basketball player. I don't even think it's arguable. I think he is the most important basketball player who ever lived, and KG says so in the piece. Everyone's standing on his shoulders, both in terms of, creating the paradigm of the super athlete, but the league was shrinking before Wilt came. By the time he left, it had doubled in size, and there was another league. He brought popularity to it, but everyone knows that story, or they think they do. But what we didn't know, and we were so excited to discover in talking to his sisters, who waited until now to do this because they wanted to make sure that his story was told in the way that they felt comfortable with, was the person, especially the kid. Because we all think of Wilt as he's the unstoppable force, the guy who can play 48 minutes. And there's a level of pain that he went through as being this kid in the mid-50s who's super tall and black in a time when neither one of those won you any favors. There was no Wilt Chamberlain before him. He had no role model. There was no idea for girls in high school that this guy's going to be rich and famous. He was looked at as, the word freak comes up a lot, but not in the sense that we think of as like the freak athlete, but as like that guy's like a carnival freak. And people don't think of Wilt that way because he was so nice and he was so likable and charming and he's in the movie with Arnold. But to learn that stuff about him, that no girl would dance with him, he didn't go to dances as a high school. When later on what he says, and you'll see it when you watch the third installment, we get into the 20,000 women quote that he put into one of his books. And to see that then in relief of who we now know he was throughout his life, it's like it adds a layer of complexity and depth to him that I don't think we've ever seen before, and it feels truthful. And his family watched it and really loved the film and felt like he was being seen.
So what I've seen so far, I just wonder how this works. There's so many women, as we know. But how did you go through that process, Chris Dillon, the director of the docuseries, Goliath, which looks back at the life of Wilt Chamberlain. How did you pick the women that you did to get them on camera?
Well, there are people, you know, I mean, first off, the claim of 20,000, it will come out, is something that is in itself, you know, probably a bit of myth-making on Wilt's part. But there are, he obviously dated a lot of women. There's a lot of photographic evidence of all the women that he dated, and there are some that became important to him who wanted to participate in this. They wanted to talk to us. One woman, Linda Huey, who was someone that he had a romantic relationship with for a long time. Another woman, Jessica Burstein, with whom he did not. And it was very important for us to talk to both because they both knew Wilt, you know, deeply, but in these different ways. And it revealed that despite Wilt's womanizing, and there's some great stuff from Carrie Champion talking about it, and Jemele Hill talking about, you know, this aspect of Wilt's life, there's far more about him that people don't know that adds complexity. It doesn't erase that other stuff. It just means there's more going on here that's interesting, including his support of women's athletics. And, you know, Billy Cunningham told me when I interviewed him that Jackie Joyner Kersee says without Wilt supporting her, she doesn't, you know, become a gold medalist at the Olympics. Like, people don't know these parts of Wilt's life. So it was a thrill to be able to kind of put them out there and let you decide, you know.
I have two Wilt stories for you. So the sleepaway camp that I attended as a kid, the founder was also the founder of the Philadelphia Spas, one of the Philadelphia Spas founders, and Huey Black. And Wilt Chamberlain, before he became famous, would work at the sleepaway camp. And he actually got fired from the sleepaway camp because he was so tall and he had some eyes that would be wandering over the shower house into where some of the ladies would shower. And he's talked about this before. I don't know how much detail he's gone into it, but eventually all those years later, he did go back to the camp and the relationship was mended a little bit.
You know, but you touch on, it's funny, but you touch on a kind of a deeper point. The world was not built for someone of Wilt's size or Victor Wembanyama's size, you know, and that wasn't easy for him at that time. Sonny Hill talks about beautifully in the piece what it was like in high school for Wilt walking, and people hadn't seen a 7-foot kid before, and just people staring at him and gawking and literally saying out loud, look at him. He's like, you know, we understand from somebody like Kareem and Giant Steps what it felt like. But because Wilt was Wilt and he was so charming and likable, I think people don't realize that, like, look, there was a Wilt before there was a Kareem. Kareem had Wilt as a role model to look to and understand, like, there's something waiting for me on the other end of this.
The other story I'll give you too, and it's funny how you mentioned the height once again. My great aunt went to high school Overbrook High with Wilt Chamberlain, and she tells this story all the time. Wilt Chamberlain sat in the front row and she sat right behind Wilt Chamberlain. Now, my Aunt Virginia Kendall is about 5 foot on a good day, so she would always tease around with Wilt. And my dad once actually met Wilt all these years later, and it was amazing how many people he remembered with all the people he had access to, and he remembered my great Aunt Virginia.
100% believe it. You're the second person who we talked to who had was in class. Like, we actually talked to someone who was a classmate of Wilt's and talked about how he could pass notes across the person next to him to the person in the other aisle, you know, and Wilt was, and you'll see this when you get to the end, like Bob Ryan was phenomenal.
Great.
And there's some stories.
Him and Jackie Mack, I thought they added such great historical perspective on
it. But there's some personal stories from Michael Arizin, who was the grandson of Paul Arizin, the Hall of Famer, that I'm not going to spoil for anybody, but they're so worth getting to at the end. And Bob Ryan talks about, like, look, and Jackie says it as well, and, you know, because Wilt and Russell, you know, were branded together. They grew the league. Their rivalry was how the league was grown. But they were very different people. And I love Bill Russell, and I have endless admiration for Bill Russell and what he did. People thought Wilt was an egotistical, selfish guy because that was the narrative that was told. And that was my big entry point into this piece, was understanding the distance between who he was. When I learned the distance between who he was as a person and the story that was told about him and how much it pained him. When he does care about people, when he remembers, you know, your aunt, when he's there for somebody like the granddaughter of his teammate from 20 years earlier, you see that, like, as Bob Ryan says, this was just a damn good guy. And people need to understand that about him.
And I thought it was really good also perspective, as we're talking to Chris Dillon right now, one of the directors of Goliath, which comes out on Friday, July 14th for all Paramount Plus with Showtime subscribers before making its on-air debut on Showtime on Sunday, July 16th. Jerry West saying he's one of the most misunderstood people he's ever seen. I thought that was early on just very powerful to kind of lay out the entire docuseries.
Exactly. That's why it's early on. I mean, that was when I was talking to Jerry West, and, like, you know, what a thrill to get to talk to Jerry West. And I don't know, I loved, like, being able to talk about the Game 7 in 69 and show, you know, Jerry West in that way. When he said that, I'm like, there it is. That's why I'm here, you know, because I was touched. I mean, obviously looking at me, you can assume that I'm a 7'1" super athlete. You know, like my life journey is very, why are you laughing so hard, Zach? You have to laugh that hard, Zach.
I know it's radio and people can't see you, but I have to be truthful with the listening audience. That's a lie.
So, I mean, my life's journey is completely different from Wilt's, but I really relate to feeling like people are, what people think about me, what they're saying about me is not me. It hurts. And for someone like Wilt, who was sensitive, as Jackie McMullen says, Wilt was sensitive. It really bothered him that people thought this about him. You know, it matters to be able to try to correct that. And Jerry saying that, like, was like, that's what Wilt felt. That's what's in his books. That's what the voice, you know, using his words, is often him talking about the gulf between, because we show you the games. We show you the never before seen, you know, UNC Kansas national championship game, you know, in 57, which started the narrative of, like, Wilt's a loser. Wilt can't win the big one. But we show you the game beforehand, so you can decide for yourself. How did Wilt play? You know, like, do you think it's Wilt's fault that the game didn't go, you know, that way? I thought I knew how the Havlicek steals the ball game played out, but I had never really watched it. And then when I watched it, I'm like, oh, there's a lot more going on here than I realized. And there's a distance between the narrative, which was good and useful to, like, sell the rivalry, and the reality. And the reality is much more complex than that. And so having Jerry say that was like, this is perfect. That's perfect.
I also thought Chris Dillon, the aftermath with all these great matchups between Russell and Wilt, when Wilt gets hurt and then they make that comeback and he's ready to go back in and his coach says, we could do this without you. And Bill goes, that kind of took away from my moment. And I know it's not the same from a historical standpoint, but LeBron kind of, like, threatening retirement this offseason once he got swept by the Nuggets. you always wonder that, okay, how does this actually play out? But it's like, what else could Wilt have done? His coach didn't put him in, and I thought it was a little unfair by Russell.
They were friends who didn't speak for decades, because that did hurt Wilt. Because when you guys battled each other, literally, there's never been a rivalry like this in any professional sport. They played over 100 times where they're matched up with each other. You know, Bird and Magic played like 20-something times, and they weren't even guarding each other. These guys, that rivalry was what took the league. And also from a storytelling standpoint, because a big part of this piece is about storytelling, the stories told about Wilt and what he felt the actual story was. You know, they sold the league on that. Magic and Bird, that became the template. You know, like, sell these two rivals. Wilt felt betrayed by Russell in that moment. And yet Wilt was the one, as we learned from Shaq later on, you know, from Jackie McMullen telling us, that was able to bridge the gap, because he was just, like, a genuinely good guy. But the fact that Wilt, you know, we get into, like, in the end, you'll see, we get into, you know, the games, how many game sevens they played against each other, and the distance between, like, it was 9 points, you know, 4 game sevens lost by 9 points, all coming down to the very end. And it's like, it's just a few handful of plays that, like, if the ball bounces one way or another, the story about Wilt is different. And the question that we raise is, like, is that really even a good way to judge the greatness of a player, especially when, you know, there might not even be an NBA for Magic and Bird to come in to help save in the 80s, if not for Wilt.
I also thought something else that was very interesting as we're wrapping up with Chris Dillon, who's one of the directors of this docuseries, Goliath, that we've been talking about with Wilt Chamberlain, was what Pat Riley said. Because you talk about the way that people viewed Wilt as selfish, and how much he shot the ball, and how much he got criticized for that. And then You see, when he passes the ball, he still gets criticized, so he couldn't win. But the line that Pat Riley gave where he said, I didn't think he was selfish. He did what was best to help his team win. I thought that was also very powerful coming from someone just like the clout that Jerry West has, then we know the clout that Pat Riley has.
And Pat Riley is a huge voice for us, especially in episode 3 when we get into the 72 Lakers. And I will put forth, and I think this is true, there is no superstar in the history of professional sports, but especially the NBA, who was willing to continue to alter the way he played based on what he was being asked to do throughout the course of his career while remaining a superstar. He comes in and he's asked, because there had never been a guy who could just dunk on people like this, who was unstoppable. You have to double him. And it, you know, he was coached, and Frank McGuire said, let's give the ball 40 times to Wilt because that's the most efficient way. And the Celtics showed that's not. Actually, the most efficient way is to get everybody easy shots. And then Alex Hannum comes in and says, pass the ball more. And suddenly they have the most efficient offense in history and they win a championship. And then later on, he's playing with a superstar in West and another superstar in Goodrich. And it's, and Wilt's had the knee injury. And it's like, okay, so Wilt, can you set screens? Can you defend? And he's like, absolutely, I'll do that too. And nobody's changed that much and won a championship and is the MVP of the finals. I don't think that's selfish. I think that's somebody who is coachable and didn't have the benefit of, you know, being on Red Auerbach's team, you know, from the beginning. And I think the story about what would have been different if they had understood how to use him when he first showed up. But there hadn't been a guy who was like, we got to double and triple this dude. You know, it just didn't exist. He invented it.
I know he passed away. We're almost coming up on a year anniversary, which is just crazy, of the death of Bill Russell. So I don't know how long that you guys have been working on this. Did you guys at all talk to Russell towards the end?
Oh, we wanted to talk to Russell badly, but when we reached out to him, it was very clear that he was health-wise not in a place. But it was important to me to find his, you know, archival of him. And I was so happy to find some of it because, I mean, the intelligence of Russell and Auerbach to talk about. He's talking about efficiency in an area where they weren't measuring the metrics. You know, they didn't have analytics, but he said, like, I can't stop him. But if I can just push him off his spot by a couple of inches and make him less efficient over the course of the game, we're going to win. And that was just intuitive, but they were dead on. That was what you needed to do. And it was, you know, in Wilt's career where Alex Hannum and others started to realize, like, you know what, Wilt, if you can get, you know, Larry Costello an open layup, he's going to make that 80% of the time. That's actually a better shot than you taking it against a double team. And you see the effect that he had. And like I said, I'll never diminish what Russell did. I think Jokic's greatness right now is in part because he's got elements of Wilt's game as a scorer and a passer, but also because he sets screens and does dribble handoffs and opens space for his teammates. And you'll see in episode 3 what he does for Jerry West and Gail Goodrich, where he's like, okay, you know what? If that's what I got to do to help, I'm going to do it.
So I know you're a big Portland Trailblazers fan.
Yes.
We're on in Portland, actually, one of our affiliates, The Game. So I have to ask you, I think Dame's going to be there at the start of the season. Mm-hmm. Eventually he'll get traded to the Miami Heat, but I think it's going to take some time. What are kind of your thoughts, being the Portland Trailblazers fan that you are, with Dame finally now on and out?
I mean, it's funny because it does trace back to Wilt as well. Like, Wilt was the first person to understand his power and leverage as a player, and that, like, I have an irreplaceable talent, and therefore what I want should matter. And no baseball player had done that. And Wilt's in the mid-60s, like less than 20 years after Jackie Robinson, an African-American basketball player, saying, like, I should be a co-owner of the team or you should trade me. Dame is following that template. Then Kareem was the next one to do, and on and on and on. And now it's just part of life. And we may not love it as fans. Like, I love Dame. Like, I think I would wish Dame would play for the Blazers his whole career. But I also understand that Dame has that power, and it's something that Dame understands, whether he knows it or not. Because Wilt Chamberlain was the first person to say, like, yeah, I think I actually do have this much leverage, and I should use it. There's nothing wrong with me using it, and there's nothing wrong with Dame wanting to leave. I'm also really a Terry Porter guy, if I'm, you know, like, you know, I feel like Terry Porter doesn't get his shine the way, like, he, you know, two finals runs, like, you know, co-best offensive player with Clyde. Like, you know, let's not forget Terry.
So last thing I'll ask you, because we get a lot of pitches of people to put on, and once they sent me the docuseries, I went through this thing very quickly. Like, I started watching it last night, and I only have a half of an episode left, and it's much must-watch kind of stuff when you're tuning in. But what do you want, Chris Dillon, as someone that was one of the directors for this, for people to kind of gain from it?
Oh, I mean, these things are they're about Wilt, but they're also about us who make it as well, the things that move us and touch us about it. And what really bothered me is what bothered Wilt, and we talked about it. You know, like Wilt was good friends with Frank DeFord, the SI writer. And in the piece, you'll see a headline from Frank DeFord for SI, and he says, "Another big bluff by Big Wilt," because everyone thinks the story is that Wilt forced his way out of San Francisco to go back to the Sixers, or go to the Sixers, because the Sixers were new at that point. And the truth is, it was really a financial deal. Like, the new owners who brought the team out to San Francisco weren't making the money that they hoped that they would make, the Lakers made, and they needed to dump his contract. They had Nate Thurman. And DeFord, in his lifetime, was befriended or introduced to Wilt by Tommy Kearns, the player from, you know, UNC, who also became friends with Wilt, even though he was part of the worst moment of Wilt's professional or, you know, basketball life. And they became friends. And DeFord wrote in his book, his autobiography, he has a chapter called My Man, where he says, "I got Wilt completely wrong. I was dead wrong about this guy." And Wilt asked DeFord, "Can you help me get a documentary, you know, made?" Because DeFord contributed to the 1999 one about Russell. And DeFord said, "I'll do my best." And then Wilt died.
Wow.
And so this piece is that. It is our attempt to let you see for yourself who Wilt was according to the people who knew him best and to him, and then compare it. You know, we don't use a real narrator. We don't write narration. We let Wilt speak for himself, but let you decide. How do you think and feel about these things? When you look at Wilt and you look at the story about Wilt, do you also see the disconnect that we saw, so that he can be seen and feel, and I wish that he could experience this. His family really felt like he was being seen, and that meant an enormous amount.
Well, it was unbelievable. Can't wait to wrap up the last half of the episode that I have to do tonight. Goliath will debut on demand and streaming on Friday, July 14th for all Paramount Plus with Showtime subscribers before making its on-air debut on Showtime on Sunday, July 16th at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, with episodes premiering each Sunday. And one of the directors of the docuseries, Chris Dillon, here with us. Chris, great to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Zach.
We'll take a time out. It is the Zach Gelb Show right here on CBS.
Life comes with a lot of decisions, and it can be hard to know the right path sometimes. A therapist can help you map out what you really want so you trust yourself to make great choices and feel excited about the future. BetterHelp offers convenient, professional online therapy on your schedule, however you want it, by phone, chat, or video call. Let therapy be your map with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/positive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/positive.
Sports Radio. I'll tell you, EJ, you make the show a lot more dramatic.
In what way?
Whatever song this is right now, I feel as if I'm on some documentary. They're about to reveal some really crazy information about me. If I'm being honest. And here comes Zach Gelb. And this is what we found out about Zach. This is pretty cool. This is awesome. I like this.
I'm glad you're rocking with this. I appreciate that.
It's the Zach Gelb Show on CBS Sports Radio. You want to know who is the most popular but also most unpopular person in my family? Well, not in my family, but being talked about in my family these days? It's actually the man sitting to my left. And Marco Belletti, who yesterday I was talking about on the air, how my sister, who lives in Colorado with her husband and my 7-month niece, ended up coming to New York for a month, and they stayed at my parents' place, and you know, they had what I thought was a fun time. But then my mom, she started to give all advice to a new mother and my sister, and let's just say got a little contentious. All right. So I said to Marco something about sleep pattern with babies and didn't – I just set him up. I put the ball in the tee. I had no clue what he was swinging at. But Marco was a little slugger. He was a star, and he hit that ball into play. And it got a lot of different reaction. Like, everyone was going for the ball. But my sister sent me a text this morning. I had no clue that – well, you want to hear how my sister found out about this? My mother was listening on the spot.
Okay.
My mother told my sister – okay. Hey, Zach was talking about you. Like, why would you do that with the details of the conversation? So my sister ends up going to the Odyssey app, used the rewind function. I'm surprised she even knew how to do that.
Great function.
And, well, when it works. And she said to, she sent a text to me, and she said something along the lines of, who's this guy who you're talking to? He's now my favorite person. And then eventually she heard me refer to you as Marco. She goes, I love Marco. He should come over for Thanksgiving this year. So my sister's a big fan of you. And then my mom, I'm trying to figure out if she actually still rocks with Marco Belletti. Because I guess she was a little bit annoyed because it seemed like you took more of my sister's side in that.
I didn't take any sides. Let's not.
Politician Belletti.
No. You asked me my opinion. My opinion is, I've always been a big believer of this, unsolicited advice usually comes across as criticism. That's the way our brains work. I know, same thing for me.
Yeah.
You know, so do you. You know what? If you want a piece of advice, it's like, hey, buddy, go to hell. Like, I don't want a piece of your advice. Like, we'll get the hell out of here. Like, it automatically comes across as criticism. So the only thing I said was, when it comes to, especially when it comes to your children and when you're a first parent, you have no idea what the hell you're doing. So there's a million things that are running through your mind. You're sleep deprived usually and all that other stuff that goes with it. I would say let them come to you because most likely, especially if they respect you, good chance that young parents are going to come seek advice. When people seek advice, they respond to it. When you give it unsolicited, it usually comes across as criticism.
Which I'm going back and looking at these text messages now with my sister. One thing she harped on in all caps and an exclamation point was the two words, unsolicited advice. She loved the way that you said unsolicited advice. She goes, who is this guy? We love him. Invite him over for Thanksgiving. When you need advice, you seek it. Tell Marco he's got the sauce with that advice about people not wanting, once again, unsolicited advice.
Again, that usually comes across as criticism. Apparently, for your sister, it does come across that way. That's how it feels. Like I said, look, when you first have kids, everyone, they people crawl out from the cracks of the walls. It almost feels like, you know, the creatures coming out from everywhere to tell you all the different things that you need to know. And what also is kind of lost in when you first have kids, every child is different, including yours, that seems to change on a weekly basis. Something that worked last week, all of a sudden doesn't work anymore. And you're like, man, I thought I figured something out. And all of a sudden, so there's a constant turnover and try to learn as you go. So the more you hear like all this stuff that's coming without you wanting to hear about it, it just becomes overload and you just feel like everybody's piling on you. Now, again, maybe every parent is a little different. That's my experience. And that's what the experience that I've had with most young parents that are starting off.
Now, one story I forgot to tell, it's not really this great of a story, but my sister was like, I'm surprised you didn't tell this story. Mm-hmm. The first week they were home, I said, you know, I'm going to surprise everybody. I'm going to come home Friday night instead of getting there on Sunday when I was supposed to get there. I'll come home 2 days earlier. Hmm. So, you know, when this show ends, it's 10 o'clock. I get on a train at 10:30. I'm there at 11:30. I'm expecting at least my sister and my brother-in-law will be up, and I'm expecting the baby to be asleep. The three of them were not even home. And I ended up falling asleep at 12:45 or something like that. Maybe 1 o'clock. They didn't get in until 1:30.
With the baby?
Yes. At this point, we're spilling all the beans.
Well, I mean,
here.
You know, yeah.
They were at a friend's house that was having like, I guess you could say, I don't want to say a party, but like a little get together.
Okay.
And the baby was just sleeping there and they were enjoying themselves.
Good for them. Good for them. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That sounds like an awesome baby.
Yeah.
To be able to sleep at all. Never mind to sleep somewhere that's not their own house.
Yeah.
Oof.
So
good for you.
So I woke up the next day of that Saturday. I'm like, I'm annoyed. Like, I wasn't actually annoyed, but I go, I wanted to see the baby and you guys. And you guys didn't get home like a bunch of hooligans till 1:30. The baby ended up, you know, got home way later than I did. It's crazy with that whole story. So... my sister was shocked that I didn't end up telling that story. But then the next day, my mother comes out of her room and she goes, you kept that baby out until 1:30? What are you doing? I would never do that with you guys.
And again, that's where you just kind of like, huh?
Yeah.
Look, I don't want to speak for everyone.
The Marco, uh-huh.
No. But I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone else. For me, I would have, if you could get a chance to get out of the house when you have a baby, you take it. And you run. And if that baby's going to be cooperative, you're going to take that thing and ride it as long as you can go.
All right, getting to this Northwestern story, because I haven't got your opinions on this throughout the last 2 days. So on Friday,
right? It comes out that Pat Fitzgerald's going to get suspended for 2 weeks in the middle of the summer. Now looking back on it, Friday news dump. All right, guy gets suspended for 2 weeks when this is pretty much the last off period college football coaches have. I don't want to say it's a vacation for him because he wasn't going to be getting paid, but you're not really missing anything and you're missing out on 2 weeks of salary. Big deal. And then over the weekend, like shortly after that, I give credit to the student journalists. They brought the information that the school's withholding from us in their investigation out to the public of what was allegedly happening. Mm-hmm. And then this just goes to a level where it's, oh my goodness gracious, you know, did the school even know about this? And then several people reporting on this story said the school knew everything that was said in that student journalist article that was released. And this was not new information to them. And then it's, okay, how do you kind of save yourself if you're the school? You had to get rid of Pat Fitzgerald. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But to me, whether the coach knew or didn't know, if he knew and he allowed that to happen, idiot. If he didn't know, what control do you have over your program when you are Northwestern football and you were what you did as a player and then the way that you were respected as a coach, that was your job for the rest of your life if you had it. It's tough for me to think that he didn't know, but if he truly didn't know, you clearly don't have a good pulse on the locker room anymore. So he was going to get fired because of this anyway. But the thing now that the way that I look back at it, you know, say what you want about Pat Fitzgerald, but the rest of the university decision-making process that thought, oh, we could just sweep this under the rug, give the coach a two-week suspension. There's other issues at the university as well. And then whenever this gets out, we just hope that enough time has passed where no one really remembers about it and cares. Everyone that's involved in this decision-making process should be fired.
Yes, 100%. There's not even a question. Everybody, clean house, all of it. And the idea that Pat Fitzgerald did not know, I find this difficult to believe. Every head coach on the college football level and every football coach, CEOs, period, they are so minute with every detail. They know everything that's going on. They know the length of your socks for your uniform, okay? They know everything that you're doing. Yeah. They don't know this. They don't know this because they don't want to know this. So the idea that they don't know it is garbage. And if they truly didn't, then you're incompetent. So either way, you're gone. So that to me is not an excuse, and I don't want to hear it. Everyone else that's involved in all the decision-making, the idea that they can even remotely tell you, we knew all this, we just didn't realize the magnitude, gone.
Yeah.
All of you, because you're trying to cover it up, because you're going for the sake of the university, for what we're trying to do. What you're trying to do is cover up problems. Stop it.
And it's not even a good sell job, because it'd be one thing if, let's just say, you made this decision on Friday, and then 3 months from now, something else comes out, like this article comes out 3 months from now, you can at least sell it as if it's new information, but the university's not even selling this as new information because of how quickly the dominoes did fall here.
You wanted everyone to be stupid, or you just thought you can get by. That's it.
That's what it was. They thought they could get by. They probably thought
money
it's
and
Northwestern
power.
Football, right? Even David Haw, who joined us earlier, who's been working in Chicago forever, he says, the way that Northwestern football used to be covered isn't how it's covered now. Like, the student journalists have a great opportunity, and they're basically like how the beat writers were back in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, even the early 2000s with the access that they have and what they're able to do. And obviously, you know about the journalism background at Northwestern, but it was just really stupid by them in the year of 2023 when there's more outlets than ever.
You know,
and there's more platforms than ever people tell the stories, so think you could just sweep it under the rug.
I would love to believe that all that is there and people should understand that, but unfortunately, money and power comes this idea that they're better than everyone else, mm-hmm. and that no matter what it is, we can figure it out. And that's the problem. That's the epidemic. Because when it comes with all this power and money, and it's wherever it is, whether university level or whatever level you want to talk about, there's always the idea that, well, you know what, it's bad, but we can figure it out and we can cover this up, and corruption is just basically encouraged. This type of situation goes above and beyond everyone. There should not be anyone that's standing, that's involved with the university, that's part of this decision-making process, that should not be out of a job. Every single one of them. Unceremoniously gone.
And the other part here too, where I asked this David Haw, and he said it was a great question, was you have someone in Pat Fitzgerald who, right, won the Nagurski Award as a player, the Bednarik Award as a player.
Mm-hmm.
He is the Northwestern football program, right. And he's been the head, he's, you know, was an assistant coach from 2001 to 2005, and he's been head coach in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I asked this question, and I would believe that if it was, let's say, someone that was there for 3 years, that was just a good coach, not a great coach, They probably would have fired him on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But they were protecting, right, their golden child, the brand of the program. And they said, all right, we'll just give him a 2-week suspension. It's us punishing him. That's significant enough. And then no one else is going to dig about this. And how you think now that no one's going to dig about this, it's crazy to me. And I'm not comparing this to what happened at Penn State. But at Penn State, you saw that they prioritize football over the well-being and the safety of children. Mm-hmm. And they thought you could just cover things up and it would never come out to light. Look how long ago that was. And now you're in 2023. Once again, I'm not comparing this directly to Penn State, but it's almost as if, once again, the just stupidity of the institutions and the arrogance of the institutions where they think they could just cover it up and get away with it because they're a football program.
That's the word. It's not stupidity. It's arrogance. They really, truly believe that they can get away with anything. It's yeah. money and power that I can do whatever. And again, if it comes out, we'll figure it out and we'll get it to go away because that's what they do with all of their problems. That's with money and power and arrogance. You know what? I have no sympathy for that. And any level, never mind when you get into this, because this story is, it's hard to even read. Like, I think I mentioned to you off the air, like when it first came out, I saw it and I looked at it and I was like, I can't read this any further. Like, I have since, but like, I don't want to see
this.
Did you
play football growing up?
No.
Okay.
No, I played a little bit as a freshman, but not for very long.
So I played football growing up, and it's amazing. And I understand there's a boys will be boys culture.
Right.
But the thought process that because a player makes a mistake in practice, which there's ways to hold players accountable for making mistakes in practice, is to bring him in a locker room and in like a cult-like atmosphere, allegedly like dry hump him. What the heck is the player going to learn? I would want nothing to do with that program.
Again, and that's why like I don't see the point of there's people when they say, oh, you got to understand that. What was going on at the time. A lot of people like to say this, you know, like when you go back to like, well, you got to understand what it was like in 1982 or whatever the year it is. I don't care what year you pull out of the sky. No point at any point was any of that make any sense or was it okay or justifiable in any way? It doesn't make any sense. How the hell does that make you a better football player? All that is trying to do is to intimidate and to degrade you. It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Like, again, what purpose does it serve? What point does it serve? And the idea that nobody knew what was going on, nonsense. Everybody knows what's going on with everything. Once you're around it, everybody talks about everything. Who are these people that keep all these secrets? I mean, like, are we serious? Nobody can keep a secret. For 5 minutes, nobody can keep a secret. This? Nobody talks about this? Stop. Everybody knew what was going on, and it doesn't make any sense. It's disgusting on all levels.
And I was reading one article where it said one of the former players said that Pat Fitzgerald would make at least five times since 2020 would make allegedly a symbol over his head to kind of say, oh, put that player on the list. If that's the case, like that was the one part of reading the story, I go, there's no way the coach could be that dumb, right? Where you're
yes,
doing that.
Because it's not dumb. Again, it's arrogance. That's the problem. They don't, we've always done it this way. Oh, okay, great. So that's the excuse? That's the reason? Have you ever stopped and thought for what you were doing?
Stupid.
Did it ever come across to you that you realized, what exactly are you trying to do with this? And then again, the answer is always, well, it was always that way. Okay, so that means you have no brain? You never stopped and thought. You're in control. You're in charge. You never stopped to give it a second. I'm sorry. I have no sympathy for any of this.
Agreed. Now, fantastic stuff. Good perspective. That's Marco Belletti. We'll come on back. We'll wrap up the show. All righty, wrapping up shop real quickly. Zach Gelb Show, CBS Sports Radio. Big thank you to Brett Boone for stopping by earlier. He said it wasn't his brother who told him this, but someone told him, but he said it wasn't his brother, that maybe Aaron Judge coming back right after the All-Star break. So how about that? Good stuff with David Hall from The Score in Chicago talking about the Northwestern situation. And then earlier this hour, Chris Dillon, one of the directors of the new documentary that's coming on out in Goliath about Wilt Chamberlain, which I highly recommend. There's 3 episodes. I'm 2.5 episodes in. Going to finish the last 25, 30 minutes tonight. But excellent, excellent. Easy watch and really informative and pretty damn cool. But real quickly before we leave, EJ, you made a great point during the break. I know this has happened now for a while, but the American League and the National League jerseys with across the chest just saying National and American. The colors are actually pretty cool, but I miss when we used to have the players wear their actual jerseys with the All-Star patch. Like, for example, you're an Arizona Diamondbacks player. You wear your D-backs jersey, yep. And then you would have the All-Star game patch on it.
Yeah, it's one of the things baseball got right. And, of course, when baseball is doing something right, they got to screw it up because that's what baseball does nowadays. Like, the pageantry of the game, whenever you see those old photos, I don't know if you've seen them, of, like, 1970s and 1980s All-Star games, you're seeing some of these historic figures taking pictures next to each other. I know that's a different time because you didn't have as much interleague play or any interleague play except for the World Series. Like, you look at those pictures and you're like, wow, like, that's a picture of Mickey Mantle standing next to Willie Mays. Like, that's incredible. Like, it's about the pageantry of the game, and they've lost that with these camouflage, whatever the hell they're wearing right now.
And Marco made a good point during the break. It's so tough to know who the player is when you're just looking at them, because you don't know what team that player is on. And also, Major League Baseball does such a bad job marketing its stars to begin with. It's not as easy as, oh, that's a really great player that I know. It's, oh, now he's in a different uniform. Who the heck is that? And then you see the name pop up across the screen. So.
Yes.
Anyway, always great to work with Elijah Stewart. Be back tomorrow on a Wednesday edition of the Zach Gelb Show at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 Pacific. We out. Enjoy your night, everybody, and we'll talk tomorrow. Peace!
For 25 years, Stamps.com has made mailing and shipping easy. All you need is a computer and printer. Imagine mailing and shipping right from your desk, anytime. No traffic, no waiting, no hassle. Plus, Stamps.com gives you discounts up to 84%. Sign up for Stamps.com today. Use code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus postage and a digital scale. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.